Well, hello everyone, I'm here. And today I have another guest video from my Canadian correspondent, the Black Horse. And buckle in, this one is a doozy. It's one of the best videos he's made so far. And I learned a great deal that I didn't know before. There's more than meets the eye to this story. What is really going on between America and Canada and this so-called trade war. Mark Carney stepped in now for Trudeau, but more or less nothing has changed here. Is there any method to the madness of Trump's rhetoric, etc.? I will say I've been pretty impressed with our Canadian friends since this whole thing started. There's a number of very base people that we know in Canada. Black Horse obviously is one of them. Another one of them is Mike from Imperium Press, who wrote this fantastic article back when this first started, when Trump first started about invading Canada or, you know, making it the 51st state. I'd recommend reading that one as well. I just pulled this little detail here that you may not know. I certainly didn't know until I read it. I'll just alert you to the bit where he says, "Patriotic bluster to one side. America relies on this nation, Canada that is, to supply it with a large fraction of the critical resources it imports, such as crude oil, 61%, uranium, 28%, natural gas, 99%, and electricity, 90%. Those are huge numbers, and I had no idea that America was quite as reliant on Canada for some of these critical resources. Well, I think that little fact there from Mike sets us up nicely for what Black Horse is about to talk you through. There's a bit of history in here, but more importantly, he looks at this strategic relationship, this more or less colonial relationship between Canada and America. Before we get there, I'll just remind people, Dubai courses at the Academic Agency. Newest one is Foundations of Shakespeare, of course. Trivium is the bestseller. Many other great courses available, but I'll let Black Horse take it away.
The question of trade is one which has dominated Canadian politics for most of its history. Canada is a vast, rugged territory with enormous natural resources, far beyond the capacity of its own capital to develop or its own population to consume. As this video is being recorded, the Trump administration has imposed a 25% tariff on all Canadian goods imported to the United States. The Trudeau government has responded by publicly declaring that Canada is in a trade war with the U.S. Based on signals coming from both sides, it appears that difficult negotiations continue behind the scenes, though a new agreement remains elusive. In this video, we are going to look at the history of trade between Canada and the United States, evaluate the competing explanations for the dispute, and fit it in to an emerging political crisis in Canada. For almost 200 years, Canada used economic force to reorient the natural axis of trade from north-south to east-west in the distinct regions of the country. The Pacific Coast, the Great Plains, the Great Lakes, and the Maritimes all have geographic features that make north-south trade with comparable regions in the United States more economically sensible than east-west trade either within the country or to partners on the global stage like Great Britain. This was done via a system of tariffs, most famously the national policy under the administration of John A. Macdonald, and a collection of huge state capital investments, most famously the Transcontinental Railway. The modern history of trade between Canada and the United States begins with the rewriting of the relationship, first with the Auto Pact of 1980, and progressing through to NAFTA, which was signed in 1992. Before we continue, I want to take a moment to take in a very famous exchange in the 1984 election debates between John Turner and Brian Mulroney. John Turner representing the old national policy-based approach to trade, and Brian Mulroney representing those interests in the Canadian government which wish to rewrite that model. At the time of the exchange, both parties represent factions within the Laurentian elite, and so you don't need to concern yourself for the purposes of this artifact with Canada's modern elite fractures.
I happen to believe that you've sold us out. I happen to believe that once you...
Mr. Turner, just one second.
Once any
you
nation,
do not have a monopoly on patriotism. And I resent the fact that your implication that only you are a Canadian.
I want to tell you that I come from a Canadian family and I love Canada.
And that's why I did it.
We built a country, east and west and north. We built it on an infrastructure that deliberately resisted the continental pressure of the United States. For 120 years, we've done it. With one signature of a pen, you've reversed that, thrown us into the north-south influence of the United States, and will reduce us, I'm sure, to a colony of the United States, because when the economic levers go, the political independence is sure to fall.
The argument from Turner here is pretty straightforward. It's an argument concerned with the sovereignty of Canada in the long term. However, the argument from Mulroney has a number of subtexts to it that were impolitic to describe at the time. The first of these is that at the time, Canadian wages were dramatically lower than wages of comparable workers in the United States. Mulroney is making the argument that by liberalizing the trade relationship with the United States, the labor arbitrage process that would follow would drive wages in Canada up towards an equilibrium with their comparable wages in the United States. The second subtextual argument here is that the hard power of the United States would be restrained by international institutions like the World Trade Organization that would arbitrate disputes between the two countries based on a dispassionate process. The third subtextual argument here is that the new relationship would free Canada from the enormous burden of making state capital investments to try to artificially reorient the axis of trade in the country towards the east-west axis. But all of this was a fantasy. Almost immediately, the U.S. broke down trade barriers with other low-wage jurisdictions, and the tailwind that initially formed behind Canadian industrialization was taken away. You can see this in the data I've collected here. Although initially, after the signing of the Auto Pact, there were manufacturing jobs created in Canada, manufacturing wages rising at the same time. It wasn't long before jurisdictions like South Korea and China and Vietnam and Indonesia began to open their trade relationships with the United States, and you saw the Canadian industrial base get hollowed out by this process, and the wages of Canadian industrial workers never climbed to comparable levels with the United States. In addition, the second leg of the argument was that the international institutions established by the various trade agreements that existed between Canada and the United States would restrain the United States' natural position of leverage in the relationship. Probably the best example of how this failed to pan out is the case of the softwood lumber trade between Canada and the United States. As part of the various negotiations between Canada and the United States, there have been five iterations of an agreement on softwood lumber to deal with the implicit subsidies to the industry that go with varying stumpage fees and the uses of federal lands on both sides of the border. On the bottom here, I've included a line chart that shows periods where there is an active trade dispute and periods where there is free trade on the commodity. You can see as often as there has been free trade on the commodity, there has been an active dispute, during which time the U.S. has collected duties on Canadian softwood lumber. Each time this has been resolved, it has not been resolved as the direct result of the many international court cases that Canada has won on the matter. It has been resolved on the basis of negotiation between Canada and the U.S., as part of the broader trading relationship, a negotiation that has reflected the power dynamics between the two nations. And as Turner predicted, Canada did, in fact, end up, particularly in the period beginning in the early 2000s, as the U.S. liberalized its trade relations with other nations, did end up with a classic colonial economy. You can see a diagram here of Canada's trade surplus and trade deficit broken down by various commodities. Canada carries a huge trade surplus in a variety of raw goods, agricultural products, forestry products, oil and gas, minerals of various kinds. And you can see that Canada carries a huge trade deficit in manufactured goods, ranging from textiles to automobiles to machinery and electronic parts. So if you were a 19th century aristocrat drawing up the perfect colonial relationship, you would see the relationship between Canada and the United States as fitting that model to an absolute T. Given the stated intention of the Trump administration to reindustrialize the United States as part of an effort to increase wages for American workers, but also as part of an effort to improve the strategic position of the United States in an increasingly multipolar world, you would see the relationship between Canada and the United States from a trade point of view as absolutely ideal in that framework. So given that context, I think we need to dig a little bit deeper to try to understand what's going on in the negotiation. As Canada's trade relationship with the United States has become increasingly colonial, there have been two responses from the two dominant elite groupings in the country. The first response has come from the Western elite, and it's a paradigm called deep integration. The deep integration paradigm is predicated on becoming a better quality colony to the United States, and the idea is that if you become a better colony of the United States, that you'll get leverage out of the quality of that trade relationship, and the United States is a good friend to Canada and would never threaten us strategically anyway. The second approach has been the approach taken by the Laurentian elite, who have been the ruling elite in this country for quite a while, and they have sought to diversify the market for Canadian goods, inviting a reorientation of trade away from the United States as the sole or near sole customer for Canadian goods, toward a deeper relationship, particularly with China, another industrial power with a lot of hunger for the kinds of raw goods produced by Canada. Both of these formulas are in crisis. Trump's comments in the direction of annexation have totally delegitimized the formula for restructuring Canadian trade put forward by the Western elite. It has made their program for Canada deeply politically embarrassing domestically. At the same time, the changes in U.S. politics that have occurred over the last 10 years have made the Laurentian elite's plan of a deeper relationship with China totally unacceptable to the U.S. To kind of deepen the understanding here, it's not only that Canada has attempted to get goods to market in China, but it has also accepted investment from CCP-affiliated state firms to get capital to develop Canadian resources. And it has, along with those two efforts, has come Chinese influence in Canadian politics. So last summer, there was a widely publicized report from CSIS, the Canadian intelligence agency, indicating that a large number of Canadian parliamentarians have wittingly received funding from foreign sources. And associated with that, there's wide speculation that a particular member of the Liberal government, and possibly more than one member of the Liberal government, are actual CCP agents. It's also understood that Khalistani separatist terrorists, Khalistan is a Sikh region in India, have significant influence in the Canadian government. The leader of the Canadian Socialist Party, the NDP, is a Khalistani Sikh who has some familial connections to that movement. the influence of other great powers in Canadian politics is a kind of red line for the Americans in behind the scenes. It's a situation not unlike the situation in Ukraine, where NATO involvement in Ukraine was a hard red line to the Russian regime. In the same way, it is becoming clear that influence of other great powers in Canadian politics, economic and political, is completely unacceptable to the U.S. to the current U.S. government. The rhetoric surrounding fentanyl trafficking makes more sense in this light. Current estimates say that something like 1% of the fentanyl in the United States crosses the border into the United States from Canada, a tiny, tiny fraction. Yet this talking point comes up over and over again in the discussions surrounding the tariffs. When you start to understand that the Trump administration links fentanyl with the Communist Party of China as a kind of new opium war kind of tactic, you can start to see how fentanyl trafficking is a nice public way of describing the intelligence that they almost certainly have, describing the very significant influence of the CCP in Canadian politics. The failure of both key elite factions at a national level to address credibly a way to restructure the trade relationship between Canada and the United States has created a vacuum of leadership. The Canadian Western elite have sought to potentially make a separate deal with Trump via their control of the Alberta provincial government. Such a deal would be a huge step forward for separatism and a huge step backward for the sovereignty of the Canadian federal government. Equally, if the tariffs go ahead, even without a separate deal, the reduction in revenue for the federal government will significantly impair the long-standing program of using transfer payments to tamp down separatism in Quebec. So whether the tariffs go ahead, whether there's a separate peace with Alberta, in either case, the sovereignty of the federal government will be substantially undermined. And so the Trump administration continues to receive representatives, not just of Alberta, but of other regions within Canada to try to negotiate. Trump refuses to make a public declaration of exactly what Canada can do to establish a new trading relationship. And so in the absence of a formula here with the rhetoric concerning annexation, you continue to see Canada spiral further and further out of control, with no way for any emergent political faction to step forward and present a political formula to address the problems. In conclusion, we've got the Western elite who have put forward a view of how the trade relationship should work. That view is politically dead inside Canada. You have the Laurentian elite that have put forward a view for the trade relationship between Canada and the globe. That view is politically dead because the key trading partner of Canada deems it, and not just the key trading partner of Canada, but the superpower on our borders, deems that program unacceptable. Trump refuses to articulate what a sensible vision for the relationship would be, and so you have this vacuum into which Canadian politics stares. Thank you for your time and attention. I hope you learned something.
Canada originally was put together by two groups of people who didn't have much in common but didn't want to be American.
The line just popped into my head. A bunch of the boys was a whooping it up. And there I got my start.
We have had a flag. Flags can be changed. But flags cannot be imposed, the sacred symbols of a people's hopes and aspirations, by the simple, capricious, personal choice of a Prime Minister of Canada.
I have watched this country for half of my life from abroad, and we have turned complacency into just that, a national sport.
I am resolutely opposed to all innovation, all change, but I am determined to understand what's happening. I don't choose just to sit and let the juggernaut roll over me.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.